This is Donald Hossig with Cancer Action New York's Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us today is Andrew Nikiforuk. He is the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Don.
It's awesome having you on this program today. I've been very interested in interviewing you ever since I read your book. And just, I'll name it one more time. I just want people to get the name of this book so they can, you know, get it and read it. It's Andrew Nikiforuk, and he's the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. So let's talk about where you were coming from when you encountered the tar sands and were the guy that did the best book on it so far.
Well, I mean, I live in Alberta and have lived in Alberta for more than two decades. And Alberta is the source of this really icky, dirty hydrocarbon called bitumen. And when we really started to ramp up production of this resource and export it to the United States, it really changed the province. And it changed the place that I love. It changed the place where my children have grown up. It changed everything about the province of Alberta, the same way that shale gas drilling has changed Wyoming or parts of Texas or parts of Colorado. And, these are dramatic events. When a civilization starts really hammering extreme resources with extreme energy and carbon and water costs associated with them, it affects a lot of people, it affects a lot of communities, it affects a lot of other resources, in particular water, these are dramatic events, they're extraordinary events, and that's why I decided to write about it, because, the average Canadian does not know that Canada is now the number one source of oil to the United States. And really, the average American doesn't really know where the hell their oil comes from anyway. All they know is that it's getting more and more expensive. They don't understand why. And they might have some kind of vague inclination that, that the new stuff coming down the pipe is much dirtier than light Texas crude. But that's about all that they know.
Okay. So what's your background as a journalist?
Well, I've been largely a business journalist for the last 20 years, and although I have a reputation as also being an environmental writer, so I write about a variety of issues, but for the last 20 years, I've largely focused on business issues in Canada, and in particular, I've really started to focus on energy and oil and gas stories, because I think that how we use energy, what we pay for energy, how we regulate energy companies are the key issues of the day. I mean, they're defining issues.
Right. So this is the explanation of how you, in the book, I was just quite impressed with your insights into what was driving this and, the economics of it, the money. That chapter, the money, I remember that chapter very well. Let's talk about the money. I'm sure that's surely a big part of why this is happening right now.
Well, definitely. I mean, one of the big drivers for this project, and I mean, this is the world's largest energy project. It's the world's largest capital project, and it's the world's largest engineering project. And at this point, you've poured more than $200 billion into this project to exploit basically three huge deposits of bitumen. And you can either mine them out of the ground or you can steam them out of the ground. And we've got, just about every company in the world is up there hammering away at this resource in order to provide oil for the United States. And so that's the market, and that's what the money is all about. But it gets a little more complicated than that. It's about the money. It's about the fact that, there's a big market south of the border that is where you have an entire economy addicted to oil. And the really interesting thing about the United States and that folks have to, wrap their head around is that the American Empire really was the first empire ever based on oil. I mean, the British Empire was based on coal, and then it sort of slid away as the Americans ramped up oil. And that in the 1920s and the 1930s, America was the Middle East for the globe in terms of oil production, in terms of having oil, the technology, the companies, the expertise, sort of the gung-ho attitude that one always finds associated with oil production. That was the United States. And for the U.S. now to find itself having to buy oil, not just from Canada, but from around the world, is a big and dramatic change, and it's a costly thing. And about 70% of the oil that the United States now consumes is being imported, and that's a huge debt on the American economy, on the American way of life. Everyone knows it's not sustainable. No one better than the U.S. military, which is the largest consumer of oil in the U.S., if not the planet. So we have this resource in Canada. It's awfully damn expensive to produce. It's somewhere between $60 and $80 a barrel to get it out of the ground and then upgrade it and then put it through a complex refinery so that you actually have something that you can put through your car. And you have all of these oil companies from all over the world who are desperate to add to their reserves so that they can continue being oil companies. So they're all there. And they're there because they want to remain oil companies. You have the Alberta government, which is basically giving away the resource, charging very, very low royalties and very low return for the people of Alberta.
Why
Well,
do they want that?
because it's the model of development that they've chosen. And, petrostates can either go one or two ways. Either they sort of give away the resource or they charge enormous amounts of rent on it. And in this case, the Alberta government says, look, we're just going to be satisfied with the jobs and the economic activity. And we're not going to be like Norway. We're not going to save for the future. And we're not going to really, take an enormous amount of money away either. So the royalty base in Alberta is much less than that in Alaska or Wyoming or Louisiana, for that matter. And it can be argued that Louisiana doesn't charge enough for its oil either, and isn't the legacy is not that's being left behind is not great for the people of Louisiana. But the model that we have in Alberta is this kind of a give it away model, and we're happy with all the with the jobs and the economic activity. And the U.S. Council on Foreign Affairs has or excuse me, Foreign Relations has did a report on the tar sands, and they said, look, the key driver here for all of this activity, and we've seen just phenomenal amount of activity in the last decade. We're now producing 4 or 5 million barrels a day, and we're tr- we, you know we, we'll have that ramped up to around 3 million barrels a day by 2020, and all for export, is largely being driven by these low royalties and low taxes. So the money is they're very issued a whole bunch of issues to the money. One, we've got this really expensive resource, so we're all going to pay more for it. Okay, so there's a question in the long term there: how long can we afford this, the world's most expensive oil? Okay, so it's not bloody oil like the stuff from the Middle East, but it is dirty and it is damned expensive. And then you've got the issue of the legacy issue for Alberta, which most Americans are not worried about. They're just worried about filling up at the tank. But the people of Alberta are being shortchanged here. You have enormous profits going to the oil companies, who are really among the world's most powerful and most profitable companies, because of the regime, the money regime that has been set up in Alberta, and you have the industry trying to tell the convey to ordinary consumers that look, it's business as usual. Yeah, the resources, we gotta dig it out of the ground and. It's so carbon rich, we got to upgrade it with natural gas and take the hydrogens out of natural gas and put it in this bitumen and enrich it so that we finally get something like synthetic crude that we can put through a refinery. But don't panic, guys, everything is okay, when in fact, this is a huge, dramatic, and extraordinary change in how we go about fueling ourselves. That when you become more and more dependent on a resource like bitumen, as light oil resources dwindle and play out. You're really putting, you know, it's like getting into a Hummer and driving down a one-way street and knowing that you're going to run out of gas and run out of road at the same time. This resource is basically telling Americans that look, your empire is going to come to an end unless you find another form of energy to run on, because you're not going to be able to afford bitumen for a long period of time. This is a transitional resource. This resource is telling you that business as usual cannot continue in terms of oil consumption in the United States.
That's a message that people are not getting at all. You know,
no, I don't think they are. It's a message that nobody really wants to talk about. The oil industry is, you know, it's kind of death on this image.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And most governments don't want to talk about this. But, you know, I think the conversation has begun among all sorts of groups, some environmental NGOs. Certainly the peak oil crowd is very cognizant of the fact that this resource is an extreme resource. And when civilizations have to start tackling something as complex and as expensive and energy intensive as bitumen, you know, things can come undone very, very quickly. Now,
yep.
let me talk a bit about the complexity, because I don't think it's obvious to most people. But all right, so you've got this huge resource up in northern Alberta. All right, so once you put it out of the ground, you have to upgrade it, and that's a huge complex system all on its own that uses a tremendous amount of natural gas. So, you know, this is again one of the mind-blowing things about this is that Canada is now using a fifth or 20% of its natural gas supply to upgrade bitumen into a resource that can actually that's rich enough to go to a refinery that then can be made into, you know, gasoline or diesel or jet fuel. And so when you have to use that amount of natural gas, and, you know, and we're using just extraordinary amounts of it, I think we're using enough to heat somewhere between 4 and 5 million homes a day to produce this really, really dirty resource. That gives you an idea of how brittle the whole system is becoming. And then this resource gets put in these the world's longest pipelines, and which stretch from Alberta now all the way to the U.S. Midwest, because most of this product is being sold in the U.S. Midwest as well as the U.S. West, but not in the Pacific states, not in California, Oregon, or Washington State yet. So or not in any great extent. So, you know, you're using tremendous amount of natural gas to get the stuff out of the ground, and then you're sending it along the world's longest pipelines to the U.S. Midwest to be refined. We know that if you have a leak on one of these pipelines, as Enbridge did this year in two pipelines, one in Michigan and one in Illinois, that the results were extraordinary. I mean, supplies for 8 refineries in the U.S. Midwest sort of dwindled. The price of gasoline shot up dramatically. At one point, they were barging oil up from Louisiana up the Mississippi to keep these refineries going because of just two leaks on two pipelines. So, I mean, this is a brittle system. This is an enormously complex system. And it's and Americans should be sitting up and thinking, oh my God, this is what keeps the United States running at the moment, and look how energy intensive it is, and look how complex it is, and look how brittle it is, and look how big it is. And you know, I think we've learned since 2008 that big things do fail, and when they fail, an awful lot of ordinary people get caught in the wake. And that's the really big danger of this whole system. And, you know, you can't be driving on bitumen unless you are at the same time building slowly but surely, because energy transitions take time. They don't happen overnight. But slowly but surely, an economy that is and an infrastructure that's not wedded to oil. And that's what the United States is not doing in a determined and purposeful way at this point in time. In bits and pieces, you can see, you know, it happening. Certainly the U.S. military has thought the most about this issue, and they've recognized that oil is a threat not only to the country's national security, but also to the country's economy and its place in the world in both the short and the long term. And so you have find different arms of the U.S. forces have plans to reduce fossil fuel consumption, you know, anywhere from 40% to 80%, you know, within the next 15 to 30 years.
Well, that sounds like a good way to go. We've been talking, I talk with some of the people that we're involved with up here, and we're in the St. Lawrence River Valley of New York State, and we don't like the high gas prices, and I really feel very, it's immoral. There's a lack of honor and a lack of, you know, just character in burning tar sands sourced gas or diesel in a vehicle and then, you know, using it for any purpose, let alone, you know, some of the purposes that we use them for. It's pleasure, really. I drive because I like driving, and I like being in different places, and I like, you know, being able to talk to different people in different places. And, you know, these are not matters of survival. This is truly a matter of, like, this pleasure, really. It's something on top of food and, you know, housing and clothing. It's something extra, but it's what people want, but there's no honor in it. In ruining Alberta and Canada and in so much of the rest of the world by using the tar sands sourced fuel. So we've been talking about developing an alcohol-based, you know, fuel system where that we would turn our – we have a lot of wood up here. We have a lot of, you know, just old farmlands that are no longer being used for dairy farming, and they certainly could be a great source of, you know, the grass or whatever one chose to distill and produce the alcohol that we'd run our cars on, because we're intent upon getting away from that dirty oil. That's not right. So that it was very good that Catholic priest out in Alberta wrote about the lack of morality that's involved with the tar sands activity, because it's very much right on.
That was actually a bishop from St. Paul who recognized that this resource poses a number of moral challenges, and it does. And I think, you know, it's all tied really in some ways to just the novelty of oil and as well as the dangerous character of addictions. And, you know, all North Americans, whether we're talking about people in Canada or the United States, I mean, we like our oil. We like running on oil. We're
yep.
used to running on oil. And we haven't been provided with many other alternatives. I mean, our entire transportation infrastructure, agriculture, medical system, everything is one way or another tied to oil.
Yeah.
And in ways, it's kind of, I see it as almost as a different form of slavery, in the sense that, you know, a barrel of oil represents an awful lot of human muscle. And in fact, according to some calculations that we're talking about, one barrel of oil contains the human muscle equivalent of having a human slave in your household for 8.6 years. So, you know, the average Canadian, say, is consuming around 32 barrels of oil a year, and that oil comes, you know, embedded. That's part of it. You use it for transportation. Part of it comes embedded in material used in your clothes. It's in your food and agriculture. It's, you know, comes embedded in laptop computers, and in, you know, oil is being used to make all of those things. So what we're really saying then is that the average Canadian, and I think Americans are close to this, it is, you know, it has essentially got a household full of 300 slaves that's doing all kinds of work for you, but it's oil work, and
yeah.
that has replaced human muscle work, and horsepower and other things, and that is an extraordinary extravagance to have that many people, you know, working for you. And I think the big issue for North Americans is that how long can we continue this kind of extravagant lifestyle, given the growing cost of oil and given the rather extreme carbon energy and water costs associated with the stuff that's left. And you know, it's interesting, you go to China and what the average consumption of oil there is around, I think it's 5 barrels or even less than that. And in India, people consume an average of, you know, 1 or 2 barrels. In Europe, people are consuming, you know, around 14, 15 barrels a year. In Africa, you know, it's still less than a barrel a year. So there are some really critical issues here that are going to come up as certainly as China and India and Brazil start consuming more and more oil. You know, someone else is going to start to have to consume less. And the big challenge for North Americans is, you know, how much is the right amount of oil and how much are we actually really morally entitled to, and how do we build an economy that's not so oil-soaked and so contaminated with this resource? And, you know, that's what we really, that the tar sands is an invitation to talk about all that sort of stuff. And yet we seem reluctant to have that conversation or even want it. And it's, you know, and it's not about shutting this project down. We can't shut it down. I mean, right now, you know, millions and millions of consumers in the U.S. Midwest are dependent on this resource without even knowing that they're
What
dependent
would
on
happen?
this resource.
What would happen if it was shut down?
If you shut down the tar sands tomorrow, well, the U.S. Midwest, so, you know, places like Illinois and the Dakotas and Michigan and Minnesota, I mean, they would, 70% of their oil would be taken off the market. So there would be oil shortages. There would be, people wouldn't be able to drive their cars. But, you know, you would have a crisis much more severe than what you saw with oil shocks in the 1970s. And that's how dependent, you know, people have already become on this resource without even knowing how dirty and extreme it is. And that really, this is, you can't build a future on a resource this extreme. You can postpone a lot of things, but you cannot get any real security from something this extreme and this costly. So, you know, that's why we need to start having these conversations and debates, not just in Canada, but throughout the United States. Okay, well then, all right, if what the hell do we start running on in, and how do we start making this transition, and how do we go about doing this in a very deliberate and disciplined way so that we don't have catastrophic decisions to make at the end of the day? And we will be making the same kind of catastrophic decisions that we made financially in 2008 if we don't start thinking about these energy issues and these really important moral challenges being raised by this project.
And the truly, am I right in like thinking that the truly catastrophic, you know, results of going with tar sands is the global climate change because of the huge amount of, you know, carbon being released, in addition
That's
to
that's
the money problems with, as far as just creating this very, very corrupt kind of money system?
well, if it's not just one of many environmental issues. I mean, the upgrading of bitumen, as well as the extraction of bitumen from northern forests, is an incredibly carbon-intensive process. And it can be 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 times more intensive than light oil. All right, that's an issue. Again, it's sort of Mother Nature saying, look, you can't run on this stuff for long. So it's making a significant contribution to climate change. In other words, it's not solving any problems for us. The more hooked we become on these extreme unconventional resources, the more insecure our climate will become over time. And so you've got that issue. You've got, you know, just the cost issue that this resource will, over time, command more and more of everyone's household budget and of the national budget. And so more and more money is going to go to oil companies or state-owned oil companies from around the world. And is that a desirable thing to have in any economy? We've got water issues, particularly in Canada, but we've, this is the world's largest energy project, and it's smack dab in the Mackenzie River Basin, which is the world's third largest river basin. You've got the Amazon, you've got the Mississippi, and you've got the Mackenzie. So Canada's, six of Canada's fresh water is all located in this area with this intensive industrial development, where enormous amounts of groundwater, surface water, are being consumed or potentially contaminated by the exploitation of this resource in any number of ways. And then the fourth big issue, I think, for everyone is just the bigness and brittleness. I mean, big things are brittle. They are not secure over time. And how more complex do you want to make the energy infrastructure that the average person has to depend on? So at some point, we have to scale down. We have to make things, centralize things again, relocalize things, consume less energy, make less carbon in the process. And, the rapid development of the tar sands just doesn't take us in that direction at all. And I think that's why so many environmental groups and so many energy groups and, are all raising questions about, whoa, where is this taking us? And is this the road we really want to go down? Or is this kind of a diversion? Or is this just kind of a temporary a transitional resource? And then you've got oil companies saying, oh, no, this, don't worry, guys, everything is just fine. we don't want you to think about how extreme and difficult and dirty and tough this resource really is.
Well, I live within about 100 miles of Ottawa, your nation's capital, and I get up there occasionally. And the last time I was there, I saw these two billboards, and they portray this woman in a lab coat, a scientist, at least a policymaker that's, thinking about science. And she's there, and the message is in text on this, picture of this woman in this lab coat in this lab, that Canada is developing tar sands in a sustainable and kind of low impact, honorable, reasonable way. And I'm thinking that is not the story you're telling me. It's not what your book tells me. It's not what the other activists and journalists and people that are knowledgeable about tar sands are all saying. Why does the federal government of Canada want to lie to the public about what's going on with this?
Well, the federal government, I mean, you've got to understand a couple of things about Canada. I mean, Canada is a mining nation, all right? It's what we do. We produce natural resources and export them on the cheap, and we've been doing this for more than 400 years, and it's part of our character and part of our makeup. And we're not a terribly green place, never have been, and probably never will be. And we certainly don't have anywhere near the kind of conservation tradition or even pollution regulations that you have in the United States. And we've been very good at kind of keeping this kind of dark side of our character hidden from the rest of the world, right? So everyone thinks Canada is this green, friendly place. We love cutting down trees and flooding forests and digging holes in the ground and exporting bitumen or uranium or nickel or whatever it is that the world wants. That's what we do. The problem, though, for the Canadian government at this point in time is that the Canadian government is becoming very dependent on corporate tax income from the resource. So, Ottawa is making somewhere between, $3 to $5 billion a year in corporate income taxes from the production of this resource. And that's a cheap and easy form of revenue for the government. Governments love hydrocarbon revenue for that reason. They don't have to tax their citizens.
Yep.
They just tax the resource. And as a result of doing that, over time they come to represent the resource because it's such a big pile of easy money for them, right? So, and that's why you have the Canadian government being not completely honest about the dirty and extreme character of this resource. I mean, there's nothing sustainable about this. I mean, there's just no way that digging big holes in the ground the size of cities like Seattle. And cutting down hundreds of thousands of trees and destroying 13 to 14 rivers per mining project, rivers, streams, and watercourses, that's not sustainable.
No.
Destroying a carbon sink, that's not sustainable. Using, you know, 12 barrels of water to produce one barrel of bitumen, that's not sustainable. Using, a fifth of the country's natural gas supply to produce a hydrocarbon that's much dirtier than natural gas itself, again, that's not sustainable. But the Canadian government doesn't want to discuss the fact that, oh, this is just going to be a short-term thing. I mean, they're looking at the money and they're saying, hey, this is great. The state of New Mexico or Wyoming or Louisiana or Alaska looks at their hydrocarbon revenues and says, gee, this is a good deal. We don't have to tax our citizens as heavily. We don't have to have a lot of sweat equity here. We'll just run on hydrocarbon equity. That's always a danger. And so then this is why petrostates are nations that export oil, you know, tend to have pretty crappy reputations. And I mean, they're not honest. They're not honest
Explain
about what they do
us.
And where
it's
they get.
Kind of dig into that for us. You know, I looked at that part of your book, and we're getting into that. You know, we just come into that subject area just now. What is it about the petrostates and the politics and the money that ends up creating a crappy, you know, less than honorable, just downright dishonorable government?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, petrostates are, it's a real phenomenon. It's a real 21st century phenomenon. And the first petrostates, of course, were all in the United States. I mean, they were places like Pennsylvania and Louisiana and Texas and California and Oklahoma. The characteristic of these places was at the time was that they would have low taxes, all right, because you've got all this hydrocarbon revenue coming in. So the state wants everyone to feel warm and fuzzy about the folks running the government. And so, you know, you lower taxes and you run on hydrocarbon revenue. That changes just the whole nature of democratic politics in the place. And that studies have found that over time, that governments that were running on hydrocarbon revenue just stayed in power much longer than parties in neighboring states. And so you tend to have these periods of long extended political reign in hydrocarbon states or hydrocarbon revenue states. And you found that, you know, secrecy about the money became an issue and regulation would become an issue. And you kind of find a debasement of the democratic process over time, as you know, political parties use the revenue to kind of manipulate the whole political process.
Yep.
And then you see that whole model kind of exported around the world wherever oil was developed, and it's incredible. You go to the Middle East, there's no democracies in the Middle East. You with the exception of Lebanon and Israel, and neither one of them has any oil. And all the rest have oil, and oil has really prevented the development of democracy there, because it has really supported authoritarian regimes. But the petrostates they come in a variety of guises. I mean, they can be left wing or they can be right wing. I mean, Venezuela would be a good example of kind of a left wing petrostate, and in Russia, kind of in many ways, I would kind of just an authoritarian petrostate. Saudi Arabia, right wing authoritarian petrostate, and when other countries become dependent on resources from these countries, then you're sort of sustaining then this kind of pathological process that oil wealth has created. It's quite a phenomenon, and it's taken political scientists a long time to kind of figure out what it's all about. And very few countries have been able to kind of avoid the curse. One exception being Norway. I mean, in Norway, took a look at the mess that happened in England in the 1960s and 1970s when they were exploiting their North Sea resources, and sort of brought to power Margaret Thatcher and some of her rather extreme libertarian ideas. And this is another thing about oil. I mean, it supports either these really crazy left-wing nationalistic programs or really extreme libertarian philosophies. Sarah Palin would be a good example. Margaret Thatcher is another. So you have, oil funds these two kinds of extremes. But the Norwegians looked at what was going on in England and said, wow, look what England has done. I mean, it's sort of, you know, cannibalizing itself and not saving any of its oil money and not investing it in the future. And so the Norwegians said, well, we're going to do something different. And they said, look, we're just going to have to take the money off the table. And that's what they did. And they put 90% of their oil revenue in a pension fund, and it's worth now $400 billion, and it's one of the world's largest sovereign funds. And so they are actually saved for the day when they ran out of oil. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they've done a very good job of making most of their political institutions very transparent. Their government doesn't run on oil revenue; it runs on taxes still. So there's really important accountability there. And unfortunately, Canada has not followed that model. So
yeah.
By buying oil now from Canada, Americans are unconsciously supporting a development model that will, if it doesn't change in Canada, will be ruinous to Canada. I mean, you're going to make us more and more like Saudi Arabia over time.
Yeah.
Then you're going to be comfortable with, or than most Canadians will ever be comfortable with. And most Canadians aren't even aware, though, of how oil income and revenue over time just changes your politics. It changes your character. It changes your political behavior. I mean, we now have a climate change policies that are just basically on par with that of Saudi Arabia. I mean, like
yeah,
most oil exporters, we figure, you know, well, geez, if we do something about carbon, and if we do something about get responsible on climate change issues, then it's going to cut into government revenue, right? We're going to be making less money from oil, so we don't want to do that. Therefore, let us assume that, you know, it's all a fraud anyway, and it's, you know, the science is confusing, and so we've bought all the industry excuses, and, you know, it's like the tobacco lobby had arrived here and taught us everything we know now about climate change, that, you know, we're into full denial mode in many government sectors, particularly in the federal government. You know, even our prime minister does not really believe that climate change poses a real threat to civilization and our economy as we know it. So, you know, Canada is now got the same sort of extreme position on climate change issues as does Saudi Arabia. And so it's extraordinary how oil revenue over time, if you don't recognize it as a risk to democracy, as a risk to open and free markets, that if you don't do something about it. And the Norwegians were the only ones so far who've really been proactive and have recognized the incredibly destructive power of oil revenue for governments, in much the same way that, you know, you give your kid an allowance and he doesn't have to work for it, and it's an enormously huge allowance. I mean, that's going to corrupt your kid over time,
right?
And
yep.
It's going to teach him all kinds of bad habits. Well, you know, governments that run on oil revenue, they get big, fat, sloppy, authoritarian, extreme, and unless they are proactive about what they do with the money. And you got to take the money off the table. You got to save it for future generations. And you also have to be very proactive in terms of getting involved in this transition off oil. We've come to the end of the line.
Clear-minded, great thinking. But is it going to go? Is that going to win the day? Do you see any places, powerful places, where this discussion is being conducted and where they're talking that kind of talk and moving toward, you know, a different walk? Is that going to happen, or is it just going to go down? Do you see your country going down the drain, or is it going to pull itself out of this?
You know, in Canada, we haven't really had yet a big national debate about this.
Yeah.
Certainly my province, Alberta, is going down the drain. I mean, we've had a one-party state for 40 years, so we've had one party in power for 40 years because of their ability to manipulate hydrocarbon revenue.
How many years?
That's extraordinary. That's dangerous, and that's really bad. 40 years.
40?
40 years.
Wow.
It's a bit like, you know, the PRI ruled Mexico for 70 years on the basis of oil wealth.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, there's no other jurisdiction in North America where you'd find one-party rule for 40 years. I mean,
yeah,
just don't find it. So, and I mean, there's lots that Canada can do, but I would say that there we're not seeing the debates we should see among political leaders in this country. You see some debates taking place in the United States, but they're scattered. I mean, and I would say most of the debates that are taking place, or even most of the conversations that are taking place among ordinary people. And I think the average Canadian and the average American would, if they were given choices and alternatives, and if they were given a program, a concrete program of change that said, look, over time, we got to get off this resource because economically it's going to kill us. Carbon-wise, it's going to kill us. And politically, it's going to diminish us. They would say, yeah, okay, let's go for it, man. Let's see what we can do. We haven't arrived at the point where the leadership there is clear. I think the Obama administration had an opportunity to make this the number one critical issue, and they failed to do so, and then they got hijacked by the financial collapse, which was very much a product of oil reaching $150 a barrel. And the world just said, whoa, we can't run on that. That is just too much money going to oil companies and to one resource. And that is going to bankrupt the whole system, particularly a system that was designed to run on cheap oil. Well, cheap oil is now gone. That fiction is over and dead. And yet the political leadership of both Canada and the United States has really failed to recognize this. But as I said, one place where they're having a conversation about this is the U.S. military. And they don't think it's smart or strategic to be dependent, to have 80% of your transportation fuels all coming from one resource, and that's fossil fuels. And they're saying, well, we this is this kind of monopoly is not healthy. It's not affordable, and we need to do something about it, whether in terms of conservation, developing alternatives, and restructuring our economy for a different kind of energy intensity.
I see what you're saying. So then is this the path that will be the most likely to actually occur and be, relatively okay for Canadians and Americans and the world for that matter? Say that the tar sands would have, got going like this, then people thought about it, decided that it was a mistake, and they certainly didn't want to, have all these bad results. And they just started gradually backing away from it and just backing out of it and like just downscaling it as they gradually produced other energy, got other energy sources going, and just kind of gradually brought it to an end. Is that going to work?
I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to work. I just know that ramping up production there is not solving any problems for either Canada or the United States. It's just making money for oil companies and allowing oil companies to kind of create this facade that business as usual is still possible when it really it's not.
So in other
And
words.
I mean, the United States really needs to come to terms with the nature of the addiction and needs to discipline its energy appetite. And Canada needs to come to terms with the fact that, ramping up production here it comes with all sorts of environmental and political costs. And the ideal thing would be for us to sort of say, look, we're going to cap production at 2.5 million barrels a year. And it's just too environmentally destructive for us to do anything more than that. And we need to signal to our good friends and neighbors in the United States that now is the time to begin a transition. But those are very difficult decisions to make when really the development of the resource has been entirely left to the free market. And so if you leave it to the free market, then a few players in that market, a couple of oil companies, are going to decide where we're going to go with this. And of course, they want to get the last nickel they can out of this resource. And they're not terribly interested in conservation, and they're not terribly interested in the overall security of the continent in the long term, but they are interested in the security of their own companies. And so they're going to press hard for more development and for rapid development, whether it's in the interest of the United States or Canada, or Canadian people for that matter. And that's the big drama that's being played out at this point in time.
It's kind of like the oil companies against, you know, everybody, you know, the sound-minded, you know, the oil companies against those that think and have concerns and want to just do this very differently.
And I think in the end, what's going to happen is that the volatility of oil prices is what's going to be the real shocker for people. I mean, I think we're on our way up now to about $120-$130 a barrel oil. The system, again, will just be shocked all to hell and will shiver and quake and collapse. And then oil prices, again, will collapse. And I think at the end of the day, the average person in the street, the guy with a small business, they're going to start thinking, whoa, I can't really afford this kind of volatility. I can't afford to run my business, run my household, run my country, run my state on this kind of extreme volatility associated with this resource, and that I have to start really changing the way I behave, changing the amount of energy I consume, and get smarter and get leaner. And it's the price volatility in the end that will probably have the most dramatic effect and will really be driving change and the march towards renewables and lower consumption and a relocalization of both industry and food production and all sorts of things in North America. Mm-hmm. So that, more than anything else, is probably going to be the real catalyst for change.
There's a ray of hope in that. I was going to, and I'm going to ask you, is there a scenario that would involve, say, environmentalism? You know, this thing of loving the earth, caring about, you know, reducing pollution, caring about not, you know, wrecking the planet on this global climate change, you know, problem. Is there a scenario where that would, do you see that in the hearts of Canadians? I see it some in the hearts of Americans and some in the hearts of Canadians. Is there any possibility that could just bring a screeching halt to the tar sands?
No, I don't think it will.
Really?
No, and I think this, that environmentalism is, I think, kind of a little too abstract for most people, because at the end of the day, you're still trying to figure out. I mean, energy is pretty basic to human life, and how,
yeah,
you know, and at the end of the day, people are going to make decisions. Well, I need this amount of energy to keep my family going and warm, and so on. And I think the environmental movement, you know, and to them, the tar sands has become this metaphor for just how destructive modern life has become, and the enormous sacrifices that are now required to keep people on the road and all this sort of stuff, And I actually think that it's an accurate metaphor, but what the environmentalists haven't really got their head around yet is this whole issue of peak oil and how that's tied into the development of this project, and they're not really asking, you know, the critical questions. I mean, there's a campaign right now in the United States to say to rethink Alberta, and you know, and because of the way it's exploiting and developing the tar sands. Well, really, that campaign should be rethinking petroleum, and it should be we you know, that the environmental movement hasn't yet really addressed the whole issue of oil consumption, of oil slavery, how much oil is an average person entitled to, what's the most effective way to curb demand and reintroduce a kind of energy security, the whole idea of energy security, to local towns and communities. And And how do we do that? And how do we relocalize food production? And, you know, how do we restore train service? And how do we make our communities much more pedestrian friendly? And how do we get down to pedal power and foot power again, or horsepower in some communities? And you know, and still keep our economies vibrant Those are the issues that kind of the environmentalists have ignored it. You know, that
I see.
The tar sands have become a big beast that they want to beat with a stick, and that's all fine. But they don't want to tackle the big issue, which is demand, and demand is driving this. And until, you know, we start really looking at the whole issue of demand and come up with some answers to that, then, you know, this project is going to be a big part of our conversation for a long time.
Yeah, I see it as the environmental, you know, war of the, you know, of all time. You know, who knows, it might be the biggest environmental thing that ever happens in all human history. You know, maybe once this gets done, it'll never get that bad again. You know, it'll just be like, you know, they just don't go there, so you don't get that terrible an environmental issue going. I'm hopeful about that. But see, the way I see it, I like talking with you because you're giving me this sense of how these things can kind of like integrate with each other and, you know, all work together to bring an end to the tar sands. There does need to be much more focus on what to do instead of tar sands, meaning conservation and also some alternative energy sources. But see, I also have this really strong belief in and history in and like relationship to this thing of, you know, heart-driven activism and this basically believing that a revolution is very much in order right now. So I'm thinking that it'd be kind of neat if it would turn out that this combination of people changing their energy uses and just being so opposed to this harm that's being caused by the tar sands development, and also just getting excited about having some revolutions, some small revolutions that could like kind of come together in a larger revolution for our society, you know, both in Canada and the U.S., that might be what turns out to be what happens with, you know, this encounter with tar sands that we're having right now. So it is going to be very interesting to see how it goes.
Well, it's in some ways, this horrible, dirty project is an opportunity for the United States to, you know, to really ramp up the whole conversation about how does the United States renew itself. Okay, you're an empire based on oil. Now the price of oil is going ever upwards, and it's coming from, you know, either more dangerous places or from dirtier places such as Canada, or from you know, from more extreme, more difficult, more complex resources. You know, how does the American experience renew itself? You know, how do you go from a country wedded to the portability, the versatility, the mobility of cheap light oil and all the wonderful things that cheap light oil provided that has really made the United States fat and lazy as a country. And how do you go another way? How do you renew the American experience? I don't think the American experience can be renewed on resources that are more extreme, more difficult, more costly. And so, you know, here's an opportunity for the United States to start having that conversation and to go in other directions. And, you know, but at this point in time, so far, the Chinese are beating the United States in terms of investments in renewables, thinking about renewables, science and renewables. I mean, China is already ahead of the United States on those things.
That's good.
And,
good to hear.
You know, and the oil addiction. Really, the oil addiction of the U.S. has blinded it and prevented it from seeing alternatives.
Yep.
That's the worst thing about oil, is that it makes life so comfortable and so easy that you can't conceive of any other way of living. And it's not just a challenge for Americans. It's a huge challenge for Canadians as well.
Yeah, I'm glad that you get into this matter of the corrupting influence of that, just that whole kind of economy and that whole kind of politics and that in the society, really. So it's like that really, so am I correct in thinking that Alberta, you know, the province of Alberta is like this extreme example of that problem, you know, this corrupting matter and this matter of the petro-state, much more so than the whole of Canada?
Yeah, Alberta is very much kind of like Louisiana in the 1920s. You know, it's when Huey Long ran Louisiana, and it's... you know, we have a government that has ruled for 40 years, a government that really is skeptical about environmental management. I mean, that's actually
okay.
The U.S. Council of Foreign Affairs discussing these folks. That has, you know, just no fiscal accountability of any, you know, responsible kind. I mean, we're not saving the limited amount of money we're making. We're not investing it in the future. We're not saving it for the future. We're not getting our fair share. And we've just become kind of a spokesman for bitumen development. And,
okay,
you know,
and what that means. Yeah, so what that means is that any idea, any possibility of environmental regulatory efforts being taken to minimize the damages that are caused to the water resource and to the air resource? You know, basically, you know, how much of this shit is going into the air, you know, when they do the upgrading. This is all out the window. You know, this is not being given any kind of a reasonable consideration by the Alberta government.
Well, the Alberta government is being forced to change some of its practices. I mean, the federal government came out with a report saying, look, your water monitoring system on the Athabasca River, you know, is third rate. And so that is now being changed. We've had so many comments about the fact that we have 170, well, you know, more than 60 square miles of tailings ponds, of you know, just lakes of mining waste on the surface, probably the largest concentration of mining waste in the world, that, you know, finally we're coming up with some kind of regulations to reduce the production of that waste associated with bitumen production. So the more the world, the more the United States, the more American consumers start raising questions about their new fuel source, the more responsive, actually, the Alberta government will have to be. I mean, it, so far, the only thing they seem to be responding to is international embarrassment or U.S. criticism. And that's the same with most petro states. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela or Russia, or, you know, they don't perform any differently either, unless there's, you know, a huge amount of international scrutiny is brought to bear on them.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. We need to be doing more of that. And, you know, we're here in New York. What I've seen that is kind of encouraging is that the state of California, I was talking to a person in the Attorney General's office here in New York State, and he was stating to me that the state of California has this low carbon fuel standard where it makes it, basically, it wouldn't be acceptable to, for the state of California to utilize tar sand sourced crude, you know, because of the high carbon cost involved. And he's talking about this OIG person here in New York State, that New York State now is moving in the direction of developing a low carbon fuel standard as well, which would make, you know, New York State and other places out of bounds for, you know, utilizing the tar sands fuel. So
those are policy tools that could help reduce the U.S. reliance on really extreme hydrocarbons. And basically, you'd be saying, look, you know, to start running on oil shale or running on bitumen is not a smart way for us to go. You know, we should be using what resources we have left at this point in time into developing an infrastructure for the future, rather than supporting basically a 19th century infrastructure or 20th century infrastructure. And you know, that's one way to go. It's not, you know, it's one small part of the kind of changes in thinking that need to take place. But when you're signing on to a low-carbon fuel program, you're basically saying that, you know, and at the end of the day, everyone's going to have to use less.
Right, which is good. I'm hoping that that'll be a big part of how this goes, you know.
Well, except that, I mean, the thing, though, is that, and again, I don't think environmentalists recognize this enough, is what an extraordinary challenge that is. You know, for the last 200 years, human society has developed along the assumption that, particularly in North America, that every North American is entitled to more and more energy. And a low-carbon fuel standard is actually saying, you know what, guys, that entitlement doesn't stand anymore, and that we have to get smarter. And
right,
that's not going to be easy.
Right. Well, it's been really great talking to you. You know, you're a real sharp guy, and truly, I talk to a lot of sharp people, but I just want to say, you know, you know, just hearing your ideas and the way you put them together and just the way you know, communicate it and what you got, you know, in your mind, you're very sharp. You know, you're probably some of the sharpest brain power that I've ever encountered, and it's been great talking to you. And I'm hoping you're going to write another book, you know, and maybe lay some of this stuff out, you know, say of like where the path out of this can be found, you know, as far as some of these ideas you've been talking about today. Do you have a website? Do you have any way that people can kind of like get to know this, all this stuff better?
Yeah, my website is andrewnikifork.com,
Okay.
and I write regularly for an internet newspaper called the Tyee, Tyee, which is
Okay.
a salmon, and this is an internet newspaper based in British Columbia that's right or, you know, right across the continent actually, but and that's where a lot of the stuff that I write about on energy is appearing.
Okay, so if somebody did a web search for, Tyee, comma, Andrew Nikiforuk, then they
That's
can
where
see
they'd
your
find
stuff.
me.
Sounds
Yep.
good.
Great.
Well, it's been great, and thanks so much for putting some of your time and energies into doing this program for us.
Okay, well, listen, thank you, Don, for your time, and I greatly enjoy this. Thank you.
Well, good luck with all you're doing, Andrew.
Right.
Yeah, we'll see you.
Bye-bye.
This has been Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Revolution. We've been talking with Andrew Nikiforuk. He's the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And we're talking about the future of our continent, our Canadian, American, Mexican continent here, this North America. We certainly want to have a good future. So let's start talking and thinking about our energy uses. Let's start working to bring the changes that we need to stay away from the horrible future that is entailed in tar sands exploitation. And just hopefully people will be good enough to accomplish all this. This has been Don Hossig with Cancer Action, New York's Cancer Action Network. This is Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Revolution. Happy New Year. This is going to be a great year, this 2011.